This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This week, we're still talking about social change to save the environment and ourselves. From the farm in Somerton, Tennessee, deep green thinker and activist Albert Bates on tough transition, how to make a local community work, even if people can't agree on why it must. Then we're going to one of the fathers of movements like transition and localization, Dr. Mark Roseland. His 1992 book, Toward Sustainable Communities, became the handbook for local and regional politicians, nonprofits, and citizens. Now it's out in a fourth edition with the goal of providing, quote, solutions for citizens and their governments. Then we'll get a call for revolution. From the maker of the movie Sharkwater, Rob Stewart says the species we need to save now is us. I've seen his new film, Revolution. It's the ultimate challenge, literally. Our do-or-die time to save ocean life and all life from mass extinction. Our coverage of the dying oceans continues. All coming your way this week on Radio EcoShock, I'm Alex Smith. Here comes Albert. Just like organisms, there are simple people. Others, like Albert Bates, are complex. He's a former attorney, a designer, a biochar expert, an author, a speaker, an international and local organizer. Albert has lived at the famous intentional community called The Farm in Somerton, Tennessee, since 1972. His book, Climate in Crisis, was published back in 1990, with more following like The Post-Petroleum Survival Guide and Cookbook in 2006 and The Biochar Solution in 2010. I've called up Albert to ask him about forming a transition community in the rural, somewhat Republican South. Albert Bates, welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me here, Alex.
I gather you listen to Radio EcoShock.
I do. I've been a regular listener since it started podcasting, and I like to listen to it when I bicycle around.
Perfect. Well, you know, in last week's program, we heard from successful transition towns in New England, and that's easy enough with progressive voters. Albert, can it be done in a conservative red state like Tennessee?
Well, we found it was certainly a challenge. Let me take you just back a step. The farm has been here since 1971, and when we first landed here, a bunch of hippies in long line of school buses coming from California, from the Haight-Ashbury, we were like Martians landing, and the people didn't know what to make of us. There was rumors going around that we were financed by the Bank of Hanoi or that somehow we were in league with the devil. And over time, we gradually won over our neighbors, working outwards gradually to help out in various ways in the community and to be nonviolent and full participants. And people came to respect us. It got to where you could probably cash a check on long hair out to about a 25-mile radius. But then, as time goes on now, I'm looking at over my fence, and I'm seeing all of the issues that are striking my neighbors in Tennessee, and we're teaching permaculture, and we're teaching natural building, and we're doing all these wonderful things here within the intentional community. But just over the fence, we've got all my neighbors who are still doing things wrong, using way too much electricity, not at all prepared for peak everything, wondering why they're losing their retirement savings and why suddenly the climate is so much warmer. And so I'm rushing around trying to do some education and trying to help, you know, because I think you really do have, you're not secure just by yourself. Even an intentional community like the farm, which is fairly well established and has become more or less an eco-village over the years, we're still not really secure unless our neighbors are secure. And the farther out we can reach when calling people neighbors, the better. And so I've been starting working with the groups in the local county. Now, there are not too many of what I call the psychographic as opposed to demographic people here, like the farm people, you know, with long hair and a history of being in San Francisco back in the day. Instead, what we're looking at is several generations of Tennesseans, you know, dirt farmers, people who were poor and remember the last depression and things like that. And a lot of them working now in jobs that are, you know, owned by outside corporations or big box stores, and so they're kind of caught up in that economy. Local banks tend to be owned by some distant corporation somewhere, and so they're sort of all stuck in that new globalized economy, and I'm trying to pry them loose. In fact, a lot of people here on the farm are working with me on this. And so around 2006, after I'd finished with my post-petroleum survival guide cookbook, I decided it was time to devote a little time, energy, and money into raising consciousness in Lewis County, Tennessee. And so we started this program. Initially, we just called it, I was already familiar with Rob Hopkins and the work he was doing in starting Transition Towns at that time, but we started just calling it Film Night. And we might bring in outside speakers, or we might have potluck dinner or something. But we got working with a local church and then a local chamber of commerce and started doing this film night and got space in the school, the town school, and started doing that. And, you know, I'm in a county, the whole county has a population of under 4,000 people, and it's been pretty stable at that, but it's very small, very rural, and very poor. And so, you know, to get people out on a weeknight to watch a movie is not always easy, but we would show things like An Inconvenient Truth or different movies that like The End of Suburbia, things like that, and to try to get a little consciousness raising going. And we would bring in speakers, and we brought in Catherine Austin Fitz, who was a former Bush administration official, but very knowledgeable about the economy and giving people good advice. And then brought in David Bloom, and he could talk about alcohol and how to make your own alcohol and immediately relate to the old-timer moonshiner community here in Tennessee. No problem relating there at all. And he could start bringing in little principles of permaculture as he's talking about how to make home alcohol. So those kinds of speakers were very influential. People here don't believe in climate change. They don't believe in peak oil. So if you raise those subjects, you get looked at like you're some kind of weirdo conspiracy theorist. And we had to kind of avoid those tripwires as we got going. So what we found was we could approach people on the basis of their Swiss heritage. This town here was settled by Swiss immigrants back after the removal of the Indians, you know, Andrew Jackson and the ethnic cleansing that came to the Trail of Tears. That all led to Swiss immigration into the area brought in by the railroads to make railroad ties from the forest here. And that heritage we could relate to because we could say, okay, when we say green, we mean no waste, frugal, okay? Let's be frugal. And so people related to that, and we started having these nights where we would just gather together and talk and come up with ideas for community beautification projects. But what we were really doing was looking at food security and personal security, bringing the lowest, poorest people up into the basics for what they need and health and raising their children and so forth. And so we could do projects like a farmer's market, a monthly flea market. We could do projects like a community kitchen where people could bring their home garden food and make it into some value-added product that we could sell at the flea market. We could do different kinds of things like a business incubator, which would start thinking about local businesses, not foreign-owned businesses here in town that would keep the dollars in cycle. And then around 2008, we had our first what we called the financial permaculture course, which gave us an opportunity to explain permaculture, but it was in the sense of improving your financial outlook. And we had 130 people show up for that, which was great. We issued chamber bucks, which was our first alternative currency here, where we would redeem your chamber dollars, which we issued in $5, $10, and $20 denominations, at any local store that was a member of the Chamber of Commerce. So it had to cycle within the community. In that way, in small ways, without actually trying to cross any red lines that would anger people, we gradually won over the population. I mean, I still get occasionally some issues coming up, like, is transition towns part of Agenda 21? Because they see Agenda 21 as this UN plot for one world government. And they don't want to be associated with anything to do with that. And we say, well, we're not political. But we did become the 25th transition town. We got the mayor and the city council, all 16 county commissioners, to join, and to every single elected official in Hohenwald, Tennessee, signed on to a proclamation. And we had the great rollout, unleashing of our transition town, and became the 25th transition town in the United States.
That is amazing. And you've raised an interesting issue on a broader perspective, too, because, as you say, when the farm began in the 70s, it was part of the hippie movement. And now with peak oil and a rotten economy, we're seeing a surge of very different folks, some with guns and deep basements. I'm wondering, is the great change going to work with such different actors?
It's a good point. And this is funny, too, because I just this past weekend was speaking at the Mother Earth News Fair in Pennsylvania. And I just happened to get with the folks at Ogden Publishers who provide Mother Earth News and a lot of other good magazines. And they said that they were a little bit concerned lately because they've noticed their readership changing. Their readership used to be homesteaders, young couples starting out trying to learn to farm. And lately, it's more the survivalists who are interested in gold, guns, and ammo. And so they're wondering whether they should cater their advertising to that or what they should do. But I think that this is a concern for lots of places, and I kind of call it the zombie scenario, okay? So people say, well, it's all good for you to leave the city and go out and live in the country, but what happens when the power goes out and people turn to the countryside looking for food? You're going to be a sitting duck. And I call that the zombie scenario, where people from the cities flood out and take over the countryside. But, you know, I don't actually believe it. I don't think it's very realistic. I think people might get 5 miles away from home, not much farther. But the thing about the countryside is it really is about taking care of neighbors and understanding that your whole population out here is one big family. You're all in it together. If we can reach out and begin to be friends across whatever differences we have, you know, they've been getting along here between the Baptists and the Pentecostals and the Methodists for years. We ought to be able to get along, too. Just by showing that we're good-spirited, good-willed, and harmless, we can get along.
And if I asked you for three hot ideas for people working towards transition in their town or city, what comes to mind?
You know, one of the things that we did here that I think is a good one, and I didn't hear mentioned on your show last week, was that the business incubator. So a lot of people, this is a hot topic in the Romney campaign, that there's all these regulations stifling small business, and it's very difficult for someone to start a small business, and banks are not lending and so on. Well, good. We don't need to be taking loans from banks. We could actually self-finance. We can create our own businesses locally without becoming betrothed to some distant transnational corporation or some vulture from venture capital. The better thing to do is to find a group of neighbors or the whole group like the Transition Towns Initiative and put together a line of credit, some central lending program where people contribute maybe $5 a month or something into a pool, and then someone can come and take a loan. And that way, you can begin to look at businesses that might be started, and you have elders who have done businesses before, and they could lend their advice and say, you know, maybe this isn't such a good idea, or maybe this would be a good idea if you just did this little bit of change to your plan, and then offer some space. There's lots of vacant retail space. We're discovering this. In this economy, one of the things that's in great abundance is empty rooms and empty buildings. And so we can actually get you retail space that would be donated, you know, if you just pay the taxes on it. You don't have to pay any rent, just pay the taxes on it. And that kind of thing, getting people together to launch small businesses and then begin to cycle the money locally within the local economy, just to keep it here, keep it moving around from person to person within the community.
Albert Bates, how do you relate the transition movement to another you helped develop, the EcoVillage Network?
Yeah, that's a good question, Alex, because I think there's a strong connection there, and the people in the EcoVillage movement have been very aware of and actually very active in transition as well since transition got started. We began organizing the EcoVillages into a network back around 1994, 95, in that period. And then Rob Hopkins began getting going with his program in Ireland, which was the Kinsale Energy Descent Action Planning process that he did in the Kinsale College, which then evolved into the Transition Towns movement from Totnes, England. And we were following along and helping out. Rob was at some of the conferences that the eco-villagers put on in Scotland. So all of those kinds of techniques that Rob was using, actually a lot of those have been tried out in experimental form within eco-villages, like complementary currencies and so forth. Really, eco-villages are an experimental vessel. And I think in terms of any intentional community, it's stronger to go out with a bunch of people and live on the countryside and do things. Maybe you can even re-inhabit some part of the city and do things as a group. You're much stronger and more stable and more resilient doing it as a group than you would be as an individual or as a small family. On the other hand, if you're out there pioneering these new things and you're trying to be sustainable in every way, it's a whole systems challenge. It can be expensive. You can run into city and county regulations. All of these things are challenges for you. And so really, eco-villages are an experimental vessel. And transition towns are taking the learnings, the gleanings of the best of the eco-village experiments, and turning those into real on-the-ground things wherever people are anywhere in the world.
So how would you compare transition communities in North America with those growing in the rest of the world?
I think North America is very slow, and it's partly, I would call, the depth of the fog or the thickness of the fog here. We've got this sort of media pollution that affects all of our brains, and we're shrouded in it from the time we're children. And to pierce through that veil and to actually see what's going on in the world is much more difficult in North America than it is in many other parts of the world. So we're handicapped. And for us to learn from other places is a good thing. But like I mentioned earlier, we got a lot of suspicion from our county people over the Agenda 21. And isn't that some strange plot to take over the world? So people are reluctant to mirror what's going on in England or Germany or Italy or anywhere else. They want to do things the American way. Well, they're in there. That can be problematic because this is a fairly wealthy country, and it's based on a cycle of consumption and waste that's enormous and difficult to break, but it has to be done. Other countries are already living much closer to reality than North America is. And so to answer the question, it's going much better in many parts of the world than it's going in North America. The Transition Towns movement struggles here. It does it by inches. In other places, they're going by leaps and bounds. Eco-villages as a movement is growing the most in the two-thirds world, out there in Latin America and Asia. And, you know, look at Sri Lanka, where there's thousands of eco-villages already. You know, to try to get North Americans to do these things, it's really an uphill fight.
Actually, you've given me some hope there. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, the alternative leader, Albert Bates. As you would know, Albert, the American South is experiencing record numbers of super hot days and recurring droughts. What is the farm doing to prepare for a changed climate?
This is actually something we've been studying for a number of years. You mentioned in the setup that I wrote the book called Climate in Crisis back in 1990, and that was kind of my awakening. I was an environmental attorney in my earlier incarnation in the 70s and 80s, and I was fighting against a local chemical company that was injecting their waste products into a deep well and poisoning an aquifer. And their argument was, Tennessee's got plenty of surface water. You don't need to worry. You can go ahead and pollute the deep well. And my argument was, what about population and what about climate change? And so in 1980, I was having to go into a courthouse and prove that there is a serious possibility of climate change here in Tennessee. And so I brought in experts, and I went to my local congressman, a young kid by the name of Al Gore, and he started looking into it and getting into having hearings at Congress and sending me the reports. And we actually won that case and stopped deep well injection, which has actually stopped fracking here in Tennessee, at least for the time being, although they're trying to put in some exemptions now for oil and gas. But it also scared me. And I ended up putting all my material together into this book, Climate in Crisis. And the farm has a land use committee, and our land use committee's objective is to try to keep our land as healthy and biodiverse as humanly possible. And so in that vein, we're looking at what are we going to do when there's 50 or more 100-degree days per year? What are we going to do when our oak forest can no longer stand up to the waves of heat and drought? What do we do when we've had 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, 6 months with no rain? What's going to happen to our fields? What's going to happen to our farming? What's going to happen to our ponds and our horses and our chickens and everything else? So from that standpoint, we're doing what we call carbon farming. And here at my EcoVillage Training Center, we've been doing carbon farming courses, teaching people about no-till organic, teaching people about keyline plow methodologies where you bring water from the valleys up to the ridges using the plow technique, teaching people about holistic management in terms of mob grazing, the way the buffalo used to manage this land rather than the current methods, and all these different techniques, adding biochar, adding compost teas, spreading compost with manure spreaders. All of those things are enriching the fields and holding more moisture, which is the key factor. I mean, we can come along and build ponds, but really we want to do is take the water and recharge our aquifers, having as much of the land absorb water and hold it when it rains as possible. That and putting cisterns on every house, catching water off every roof, and having lots of ponds in the landscape.
Well, we've got some great ideas. We've got some great science. We've had some good experimental work. We kind of know what to do, and yet something's holding us back. The old paradigm is still dominant. What is it?
You know, if I had the answer to that, I would be a very wealthy man. How do you change people? What's the we carry this neurobiological baggage going back to our reptilian brain where we're attracted by shiny things and we consume and then we throw away. And these kinds of things are inbred to a degree, and we can deal with those by training our children better to be more responsible and to not waste. But it's a long process, and there's a lot of resistance because we're taught in quite the opposite for the most part today. So how do we do it? My feeling is shows like this, Alex, what you're doing on the radio, we need to get that more. We need to have our media filled up with this. We need to have celebrities coming out and doing movies about this sort of thing that are actually entertaining. We need to have the popular culture take this on as a fashion. That's my idea. And I'm beginning to call it cool, because I think cool is a more attractive word than global warming. I like the carrot rather than the stick. And so I want to adopt a lifestyle that's cool. I want to plant as many trees as would necessarily offset my personal footprint from travel. I want to have my food come out of a garden which is actually sequestering more carbon than it's sending to the atmosphere. That's cool. That's cool living. And so having cool living, I think some ways to attract people into this as a fashionable statement, as something that people do with a sense of pride, I think is a good thing.
Well, listeners, I'll put some links to the work of Albert Bates in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. Albert, would you care to give us a couple, like maybe your Twitter feed or a Facebook page or a blog or something?
Yeah, since I did the post-petroleum survival guide, I had kind of a surfer theme in that, because I thought that that's kind of what we're doing here, is we're surfing all these volatile waves of peak everything. And so I'm calling myself Peak Surfer, one word. And so on Twitter, it's at Peak Surfer, and my blog is peaksurfer.blogspot.com, and you'll find my work linked all from there. And also, our main website for the farm is thefarm.org.
Well, as a former surfer, I endorse all that. From the farm in Somerton, Tennessee, we've been talking with one of the biggest and best alternative thinkers and activists of our times, I think, Albert Bates. Albert, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Alex, and have a good day.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. Deep Forest, Computer Machine.
Thank you.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock, now broadcast by over 60 college and community radio stations in the United States, Canada, Britain, and Australia. I'm Alex Smith, saying, as we head into a crisis of energy, economy, and the environment, we need alternative voices more than ever. Please support your local nonprofit station. We've been talking about transition from Europe through New England to the American Deep South. There is more to come. We can't stop talking about what to do, except to get busy doing it. Transition has some surprising support from local governments, perhaps more than you know. A lot of mayors, faced with very tough economic times, without enough help from national governments, they are leading the way. They are the green mayors with a vision of cities with much lower carbon emissions, much less dependent on fossil fuels, and a good food supply. They want a sustainable future. This wave has been building since at least 1992. As we'll hear, the few expert pioneers out there have become a network of community builders, a huge database of folks from around the world that are connecting. It's one of the signs of hope. I'm going to challenge you to tune in with a slightly different language, with new ears, to one of the pioneers of localization and sustainable community, Dr. Mark Roseland. It's a messy world. We are bombarded by negative stories. Big governments seem to fail to make our lives better, and they can't seem to save us from threats like climate change either. Many of our Radio EcoShock guests say only local governments are worth your political attention. And that's why you need to hear Mark Roseland. He's been advising local governments how to build on a human scale for cities that can keep going through many challenges. Dr. Mark Roseland is director of the Simon Fraser University Center for Sustainable Community Development, and he's a professor in the Resource and Environmental Management Program. You know, Dr. Roseland came to our attention back in 1992 with the release of his best-selling book, Toward Sustainable Communities, Resources for Citizens and Their Governments, and that book is being released in a fourth edition in September 2012. Mark Roseland, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
You know, at first, I had a hard time approaching your work. There were acronyms I didn't know. I was wondering to myself, is anything real going on here? And then I started to clue in. So why don't you tell us about one or two projects actually built with your advice or involvement?
Sure. Well, one of them that I've been very involved with is the community at Simon Fraser University. It's actually a community, a neighborhood of the city of Burnaby, where Simon Fraser is located, but it's called University. And I have been on the board of the trust that is developing that community since its inception in about 1999. So I've seen that from just a really an idea to a community that now has about nearly 4,000 residents and has a school and daycare center, all kinds of great amenities, and will eventually house at least 10,000 people. And we are trying there to do many of the things that I have written about in my books and other research, the kinds of things that many municipalities are trying to do as individual initiatives, are trying to put them all together at university.
Well, I think one of the interesting things about that, first of all, I went to Simon Fraser University around 1968 when it was a hotbed of activity, and I live downstream from you, and I noticed that Simon Fraser has sort of looked after its own water runoff and things like that, so our salmon stream can keep going. But I want to get a little bit more detailed. You were at the Rio Plus 20 conference in Brazil last June, and most pundits called it a total failure. Governments wrote another useless document, they said, but I know the gathering was a hotbed of networking for activists like yourself. For example, you launched something called Community Capital. Now, what is that?
So let me just say about the Rio event. The media attention was on the 175 or 200 heads of state from around the world. And I would agree that what they actually signed was an extremely weak document. But what was interesting about Rio was not those 200 people, but the 50,000 others who were there. And that was an amazing group of people who came from all around the world to share ideas, share successes, talk about strategies, and essentially do whatever we could to move the agenda forward. because if it's not going to be moved forward by the United Nations, then it's got to be moved forward by somebody, and that's why we were there. So in terms of community capital, my book, Toward Sustainable Communities, uses a community capital framework. And those who are familiar with the sustainable development literature will know that most of the discussion in North America and around much of the world is, and since Rio in 92 and the Brundtland Commission report, Our Common Future, in 1987, has talked about sustainable development as an integration of three aspects or pillars, some would call it, and it's the ecological, the economic, and the social. And while people give a lot of lip service to the integration of those three, in practice, it's very hard to do, and people don't really know what to do with them. We know about the ecological. We know a lot about ecological integrity. We don't know quite so much about how to do economic development that's not at the expense of the environment. And then the social dimension of sustainability, there's a lot of confusion about what that means. What is social sustainability? So what I've done with the community capital framework is make something that's a little more nuanced than the sort of three legs of sustainability, but a lot easier to deal with than a human brain, than 200 indicators. Firstly, I've taken the concept of sustainable development, sustainability, and I do think talking about it in terms of assets rather than deficiencies is really important. In many communities are looked at by others in terms of their deficiencies, and it doesn't really take advantage of what they do have. So when I use capitals, that's really my way of talking about assets. But the other reason I use the term capital, quite frankly, is that in our society, even though, you know, people don't necessarily have money, they understand the notion of capital really well, whereas they don't understand natural systems nearly as well. So I've broken down sustainability into six capitals: natural capital, physical capital, economic capital, human capital, social capital, and cultural capital. And in the book, they appear as a hexagon. And in the center, they are held together and catalyzed and coordinated by what I call community mobilization. So one of the things that's exciting about the new book is that I've been playing with this framework for a while, but we've turned this into a community capital tool. So I've taken this basic hexagon and worked with colleagues at Tilburg University in the Netherlands. And we now have this wonderful free online tool that's in English and Portuguese and Spanish and will hopefully be in other languages in months and years to come. And it allows people to get a good visualization of sustainability. So when a community is trying to make a decision about what to do, or a choice between two proposals, or whether to do a certain project or not, this tool provides a really good and quick and easy way for people to see what the effect of a decision would be on each of these six forms of capital. So it's useful from that perspective in terms of really getting communities to, the purpose is to get communities to develop a shared analysis, a shared understanding of where they are and who they are, because particularly in well-educated communities, everybody's right. And when everybody's right, you don't have a shared understanding. And if you don't have a shared understanding, you can't develop a shared vision or a shared agenda. So the whole point of the community capital tool is to allow us to find a shared understanding of our situation so that we can develop a shared vision and a shared agenda.
Well, I know you're talking about a lot more than money here. You're talking about the resources that we all have that we could contribute as a community. But there is the question of money. And as you know, all around America and Europe, cities are just loaded up with debt. And there isn't that much money for greening in the developing world either. Some of them are struggling. So how can cities get anything progressive done while they may be laying off police or cutting social services? What do you see happening in this framework?
Well, you know, that's the interesting thing, that at Rio plus 20, so 20 years after the original Rio conference in 1992, we're really still talking about what sustainability means. Because if you interpret sustainable development as really just environmental protection, which is what most people are still doing, then it's an added cost to be traded against, and you're going to trade it off when times are tight against other really important things, like social services and affordable housing and so on. But if you see sustainability and sustainable development as an integration of environment, economy, and social inclusion, then it's not so much a trade-off. It's about doing development differently. So in my view, when we build affordable housing, but it's not green, it's not energy efficient, it's simply not good enough. Or likewise, when we build green buildings that aren't affordable, that's not good enough. To be sustainable, we have to win on all of these scores.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Sustainable City Design Specialist Dr. Mark Roseland from Simon Fraser University in Canada. You know, another thing that comes to mind as we talk about this, there is a strange resistance to becoming more sustainable developing in the United States. Unbelievably, a few people in the Occupy movement in the U.S. are afraid any move towards sustainability is part of a United Nations plot to take over the world. They think everything's part of Agenda 21, which came out of the first Rio conference. So I have to ask you straight out, are you part of a plot to take over the world?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm holding my breath because I'm going to do it so soon. No, it's actually funny that you should mention this because it's something I've been watching with great interest, not from the Occupy group. I don't know where they're getting I do know where they're getting it from. The pushback to sustainability is not coming from Occupy. It is coming from the Tea Party in the United States. And the Republican National Committee in January of 2012 targeted Agenda 21 specifically, you know, in, as they usually do, as a United Nations plot to have international agreements be more important than national sovereignty. And so, you know, this is nothing new from the right wing in the United States when they're talking about the United Nations. That's nothing new. But what is new is that they specifically targeted ICLEI and local Agenda 21. And ICLEI is an acronym that stands for the International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives, an organization that is of, by, and for local governments, and has changed its name in recent years to ICLEI Local Governments for Sustainability. Now, I do a lot of work in cooperation and partnership with ICLEI. The foreword to my new book is written by the Secretary General of ICLEI. So I take this attack on ICLEI to somewhat personally as, at least indirectly, an attack on exactly the work that I do. And it would be laughable were it not for the fact that the facts that they come up with are not facts at all. I'm just amazed at the stuff that came out of the Republican National Committee that has been parroted by local Republican National Committees around the U.S. And there's no evidence for any of it. It's just made up. But what is happening is that local governments are basically being discouraged from joining ICLEI, from paying their dues, and from efforts to combat sprawl and to fight climate change. They're being told that this is some kind of, you know, international conspiracy, and it's just nuttiness. It's absolutely insane. The work that local governments are doing is clearly what's leading any progress that we're having. If we look over the last 20 years from Rio 92 to Rio 2012, with very few exceptions, we have seen very little in the sense of international agreements or national governments taking a lead on this stuff. The action and the traction has been at the local level, to some extent from the civil society and a few sectors of socially responsible businesses, but it's largely been from local communities leading the way. And I think Rio plus 20 just confirmed that, you know, if we're putting all our hopes on the United Nations to solve the planet's global problems, we're pretty hooped. So it is definitely going to be leadership from the local level yet again.
Right. We've been talking about ICLEI, and listeners, you can Google that and find out more about it. And Mark Roseland, I think some paranoid Americans are missing a chance at their best allies. I've even seen attacks on transition towns as a communist plot. But these same people are calling for three things. They want local action, they want participation in local governments, and they want to prepare for disasters, or calling it prepping. So isn't that exactly the sorts of things that you're helping local governments to do?
It is and it isn't. So, I mean, a lot of this stuff is very similar to the survivalist movement, which seems to have reared its head again of the late 70s and early 80s. And the modern version of that, in some ways, is in Transition Towns, which comes out of the notion of resilience, and it's a nice idea. It comes out of the natural sciences, and it says that we need to be resilient, to be able to withstand shocks, and those can be economic shocks, ecological shocks, social shocks, and that's good and that's important. But withstanding shocks is a notion, and resilience is a notion that works better when you're looking at ecological systems and ecological communities than it does when you're looking at human communities, because there's nothing about transformation necessarily in the notion of resilience. Now, Transition Towns, I think, is one of the better versions of that. But what's important about sustainability is that the argument in sustainability is not that we need to simply maintain what we have in order to keep it from being injured or devastated by natural or other disasters, but that we need to become a better society, that we can't just freeze ourselves where we're at, that to become an ecological society or sustainable society, we, again, like the community capital framework, we have to improve our scores on all of these counts, all aspects of community capital, or all pillars of ecological, social, and economic sustainability. If we do only one at the expense of the others, it'll come back to bite us.
Well, I guess some of our listeners are going to disagree with you, because I know we have people who think that cities are not sustainable just in their nature, that they must always be gathering more and more from a hinterland or from a global hinterland that won't be able to supply the billions of people who live in them. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, indeed. Most cities are not sustainable, and you can't really look at a city on its own, because cities do have what my colleague Bill Reese has termed an ecological footprint, and that footprint tends to be larger than the cities themselves. So you have to look at cities as certainly urban regions, and in a global economy, in a global society, they are international centers as well. But the point is that cities are where most people live. They are the source of many of our most serious ecological problems, and they're also where the potential for ecological solutions lie.
Well, let's look at another thing that you launched at Rio Plus 20 last June, and that was Pando. Why the name, and what does Pando do?
Pando, let me tell you what it is first and then the name. Pando is a network that links sustainable communities researchers like myself with sustainable communities practitioners like local government and corporate sustainability officers. The reason for doing Pando is that the book is in its fourth edition. As you said, the first editions were subtitled Resources for Citizens and Their Governments. In 2012, I struggled as I was putting together this fourth edition. What is a resource book in 2012 and beyond? Will anybody even read books anymore in 2015? I don't know. But certainly I felt that a resource book would be obsolete before it was even made it to the printer. So I changed the subtitle from Resources to Solutions. So the new book is called Toward Sustainable Communities, Solutions for Citizens and Their Governments. And the way I dealt with the resource issue was that I had been working with ICLEI and with researchers in British Columbia and around the world for some time, and we have not been as well organized as we, I think, need to be. So the idea with Pando was to create a network where we could find each other more easily, where researchers could find each other, where researchers and practitioners could work across their kind of cultural gap between those of us in the academic world and the research world, and those in the municipal and government and business world, so that we could really increase our capacity to solve problems and mobilize collaboration. Because amazingly enough, even though there's a lot of us out there now doing this kind of work, it's the institutional structures that we work within make it difficult to work together. So that's where Pando came from. The original name was the Sustainable Communities Research and Practice Network, but that's such a mouthful. We needed something that was short, like Facebook or Twitter. And after many, many brainstorming sessions with everybody sitting around a table with electronic thesauruses and things like that. We came up with Pando, and why Pando? Pando refers to the grove of aspen trees in Utah's Colorado Plateau. There are some 87,000 individual trees, but they're actually all connected at the roots. It's actually a single living organism, and it's one of the largest and oldest and most resilient organisms on the planet. And to us, that was a really nice symbolic representation of many separate people working together. And so that's why we called it Pando. And listeners can go to pando.sc and check it out themselves.
Well, maybe that's a really good sign that there are just so many ideas coming from so many points around the world about what we can do, that we need a centralized register to find out what it all is going on.
Well, I think that's part of it. Again, we're not trying with Pando to be a website, although it has that quality as well. I mean, there's lots of websites. Anybody can go to a website, but this has more of the, there's a public side of Pando, which anybody can go to and see information. So as I said, you know, how does a resource book stay current? Well, it's not. So the resources are constantly being updated by, not only by me, but all the other people who are on Pando are uploading their own resources. And so that's how I dealt with the question of a resource book. But the more important thing is that on Pando, you can find other people who are interested in this kind of work. And we have been, I mean, when I started doing this work 20, 25 years ago, I mean, you know, I could count on one hand the number of other researchers who were, you know, working actively with communities and with cities in this area. Now there are several hundred of us, and you know, there are people working in local governments who are the sustainability officers, and people in corporations who are VP sustainabilities. There are academics who have chairs in sustainability. There are people getting degrees in sustainability. None of this stuff was happening 20 years ago. So it's the sustainability world has really blossomed in a wonderful way. And it's clearly more than any one person can keep a handle on. And that's a great thing. But what we're trying to do is actually, as I said, mobilize collaboration. So on Pando, if you sign up, which is free to become a member of Pando, then you can contact other members directly. You can post announcements. You can say, I'm looking for a collaborator for an international grant proposal or whatever it is that you're looking to do. And you can also do things like say, I am going to this conference. Is anybody else on Pando going to be there? And if so, let's meet for coffee. So it has some of that Facebook type of quality of really trying to see networking, not only in the digital modern sense, but in the pre-digital sense that some of us older folks appreciate, where networking is a verb. It's something that we do with other people, not only something that happens on a computer.
Well, Mark, as we wrap up, maybe we need a couple of success stories. Could you just tell us about one or maybe two projects in some part of the world where cities have really improved their sustainability?
There are really lots of these. One of the things I did in the new edition of the book that I hadn't done before was a chapter on communities integrating sustainability. Because in the early editions, we just really couldn't say that we had that. We had cities that had done fantastic things on transportation infrastructure or on waste and recycling or on, you know, one particular aspect of sustainability, but not sort of pulling it all together. Now we're starting to see cities reinvent themselves under a sustainability framework. So one of them that gets a lot of attention is the city of Malmo in Sweden. ICLEI had its World Congress just prior to Rio+20 in the city of Belo Horizonte in Brazil, which has also done wonderful things around food security and participatory budgeting. We have, I mean, really just a growing list of communities ranging from sort of high-tech things like Masdar in the United Arab Emirates, to my own community that I've been involved with, as I mentioned earlier, University at Simon Fraser University. One of the examples I think that's very interesting from University is we've just opened a child care center that is not only built according to the LEED standard, LEED is Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, but to a standard called the Living Building Challenge. And this means that this building not only produces all of its own energy and harvests its own rainwater and recycles its own waste, and it's basically contributing more to the world that it's taking, and we're building our buildings on former parking areas that are no longer necessary because of good transportation initiatives. So there's all of those kinds of things. But in addition to this child care center being a wonderful example of a green building, perhaps what's most important about it is that we are seeing a green dividend rather than a green premium. So this building, many people still assume that to build green costs more, and to do things sustainably costs more in the short run and or the long run than to do things conventionally. But we have built this building to cost 15% per square foot less than a conventional child care center being built in the same region. So that's what I mean by the green dividend. It's starting to pay off. And if we start to use the community capital framework, if we start to really see that sustainability is about integration and not about trading off environment for economy or economy for social inclusion, but to do all of these things, then it's going to pay off financially and socially and ecologically.
You have been listening to Dr. Mark Roseland of Simon Fraser University on Radio EcoShock. Find out more on my show blog at ecoshock.info. I'll toss in lots of links to Mark's work. And look for Mark's new fourth edition of his classic Towards Sustainable Communities, Solutions for Citizens and Their Governments from New Society Publishers. Mark Roseland, thank you so much for letting us know about these positive changes.
My pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
I can feel the weather change. I can see it all around. All around. Can't you feel a new wind blowing? Don't you recognize that sound? That sound. Slowly spinning, spinning slowly, slowly changing. I feel something in the air. I feel the rumbling in the ground. I feel the rumbling. I feel the rumbling in the ground. I feel the rumbling. I feel a rumbling in her ground. I feel a rumbling.
Yes, Neil Young, here's a rumbling. That's from his 2010 album, La Noise. Earlier you heard clips from Brian Eno's instrumental, The Big Ship. I love it. There is a rumbling, that kind of low noise of something big coming, but we can't quite tell what. The mass media news is one big distraction. As the headlines scroll by, I have this creepy feeling there are big stories not being told. One of them is pretty simple. We have built a consumer machine that is chewing up the planet, spitting out toxic waste. Most of the greenhouse gases we pour into the sky are being sucked into the ocean. Radio EcoShock guests like paleoclimatologist Peter Ward have made one thing clear. The ocean makes the oxygen we breathe. The ocean determines the weather. And in the big picture, the state of the ocean dictates that big biological clock of abundance or mass extinction. That's how it works. That's how it is. Today I saw more graphic evidence the ocean is far more disturbed than our weather. Rob Stewart set out to save the sharks from the lunacy of shark fin soup. His audience, and then the ocean experts, told Stewart he was missing the big story. Despite the success of his first film, Sharkwater, Stewart had to fight once again just to make his second film. He spent another 4 years traveling hard to the biological hotspots of the ocean and to the dead zones. What he learned inflamed him. Stewart found out what we all know in our hearts. We need a big change fast in our economy, in our culture, and in our hearts, not just to save the sharks or the polar bears, but ourselves. He's calling for nothing less than revolution. That's the title of his new film.
The conclusion we've come to is that we built a system doomed to fail. Think of yourself as a body, as an organism. You know your consumption. You know how much food you need to take in a day to survive. You know if you ride a bike, if you drive a car, what you're consuming and what level of destruction you bestow upon the world. But expand that vision a little bigger. What if you were to think of your house as an organism? What if you were to think of this whole science center as an organism, as Toronto as an organism? Think of the consumption of these larger bodies. You know, what does it take to keep Toronto going, to keep New York going, to keep Hong Kong going? These are not sustainable. To feed Toronto, to put the energy in Toronto, you've got to go to the natural world, destroy a bunch of it, ship it here, and that's what we've been doing. And that's why our very life support systems are in jeopardy this century. By the middle of the century, no reefs, no rainforest, 9 billion people, not enough food for everybody, not enough water. We are in trouble. So the issue now is save the humans. This is the biggest issue humanity's ever been up against. It's not like a world war. It's not like we're going to battle to save Great Britain. Now we are in battle to save civilization. And the scientists, they're pretty unanimous on this. We're consuming too much in every level. There's not one trend, not one environmental trend other than the ozone layer and whaling that we've turned around for the positive. We've known about climate change for 100 years. We've known about deforestation, overfishing. Every single one of these issues has gotten worse.
You just heard a clip from the TEDx Youth Conference in 2011 in Toronto. The movie Revolution has just been released at the Toronto Film Festival and again at the Vancouver Film Festival. It's a full-length bundle of astounding underwater photography, followed by a quest to find out who can stop our civilization from destroying the ocean and ourselves. We are introduced to creatures hidden below the waves, like a relative of the octopus that is smarter than your house cat, crazy and adorable animals that only nature could dream up. It's a rich life, and it's a dying life. The ocean is becoming acidic. It's getting hotter, and it's filling up with plastic and chemicals. The single biggest threat to all sea life, greater even than deforestation, which does affect the oceans, is the way we dump fossil carbon into the atmosphere. Estimates range from 33 to 50% of all the carbon dioxide we emit from our tailpipes and our coal plants and all the things we make goes into the ocean. Everything that makes a skeleton, from tiny plankton through coral to all fish and sea mammals, they're all endangered by ocean acidification and climate change. If we can't control our emissions quickly, we can't save life in the sea. Stewart rediscovers what I found out in 1990. The oceans campaign is the climate campaign, is the oceans campaign. So the shark man ends up at two UN climate conferences. Both fail miserably. Dependent on consensus, you have negotiation wreckers like Canada just out to promote the dirty tar sands oil, and the talks go nowhere. You and I aren't changing much either, even though we know. Stewart glumly tallies up his own carbon pollution, and it's too much, just like mine. Who isn't invested in the climate death machine? It's the children. They will bear the ruined climate, and they don't have that investment in the way we live now. Child activists are springing up all around the world. Stewart tirelessly reaches out to them, informing, warning, inspiring youth as our best hope. Next week, I'll bring you a full interview with Rob Stewart, underground filmmaker and unlikely revolutionary. We'll also hear from Lester Brown of the Earth Policy Institute. He's got the facts on rising food costs at home and foodless days abroad. And we'll continue our transition series with food localization in the poorest neighborhood. We opened Radio EcoShock this fall with Gareth Renowden. He and co-host Glenn Williams have managed a new edition of The Climate Show, bridging the time gap between London and rural New Zealand. Check out the new program at theclimateshow.com. Another tip from the film Revolution: only you can educate yourself. Sorry, whatever school you went to didn't teach you what we all need to know. The government won't tell you. Media plans to distract you. As the hard facts roll away the delusions of this mass suicide pact we are living, I encourage you to dig, dig, dig. You can get college-level knowledge free in YouTube and Google Lectures, the cutting-edge science. Watch the TED Talks. Bulk up on your list of blogs that tilt towards natural reality and science. You can find every back show of Radio EcoShock on our website at ecoshock.org. That's free. You can download them. Please tune in and spread them around. Use those links, Facebook, Twitter, everything. Hand out copies to neighbors or on the street. Talk it up. Some of the world's best experts are straining to teach us what they know. We have to strip away layers of ignorance and greed. We need to know the truth, and then we need to act on it. Nothing else will save a livable future for our descendants who we love so much. That is the big story. I'm Alex Smith. This has been Radio EcoShock. Join us next week.